Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Thanks for joining me today. His name was Carlos Luis Salazar. And when his mother had troubles, I more or less stole him. Or that's what I always said. He was the son I wanted, and I did get him for a while. So begins Jerry Parker, A Thousand Voices, her new memoir of the remarkable relationship between a young single woman and the wild, beautiful boy who for a time took the place of the son she'd lost. Jerry Parker first met Carlos Luis Salazar in 1964 when she was a high school teacher in Ogden, and he was a student at the Utah School for the Deaf. He was 10 years old, and she says more otherworldly than childlike. A Thousand Voices is a meditation on the limits and the limitlessness of human language. Jerry Parker grew up exploring riverbanks and forest paths in a sawmill her grandparents had or lived there in Yellowstone National Park. And she returns to that area to write with an old desk with a view toward the Tetons. Taught high school and university students for many years, and she's won for prizes for her writing. And she's also an artist and presently co-owner of Wildflowers Bed and Breakfast in Salt Lake City. Jerry Parker, pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to join you.
Let me talk a little bit about your history first. As I mentioned there, your biography grew up at least summers up near Yellowstone National Park, and I guess probably a great appreciation of nature there.
Nature's the deep current for me, and I'm lucky to have the solitude for writing that provides. I still go back every summer. When I was younger and crazier, I decided I couldn't live without it. The sawmill was no longer in operation, and I took a shovel up into the mountains and staked out a spot and started digging holes and built a cabin up there.
You built a cabin by yourself?
I did, but as with this book, you started and everybody comes to help. It was a community project.
Yeah.
At one point, the local REA, the Rural Electric Association, manager said, go help that woman on the hill that's building a cabin by herself. They came up and put free electricity in, and I put away my little 11-inch chainsaw.
And it's like that writing a book, you're saying as well, people come and help.
I love what John Brain had to say, a wonderful British writer, wrote, that wonderful movie with Simone Signoret and Yves Montand. He said, if you do your best work, the right people will be there to help you. And that was a real guide to me. I just said to myself, your business is to do your best work, and it'll play out from there. And it did.
Now, you write that as a young teacher in the 1960s at Weber, is this Weber High School? Students sort of gravitated toward you. I guess you were maybe younger than some of the teachers, but also you'd done a lot of traveling by that time.
I'd done a lot of traveling, and I skied, and that's about all it took. I don't mean to say that I didn't take teaching very seriously. It was my favorite thing of anything I ever did in the working world. But I felt close to them. I could remember what it was to be a student. You know, Tom, the one thing I remembered was how much I hated to be bored, and I really tried not to have that be their experience. And they were wonderful. It was a wonderful time to teach.
In fact, the students would congregate in your office. You'd have trouble getting away some days to go and visit Carlos at the School for the Deaf.
It's true. I love to remember it.
I wonder if you could maybe just read the first, page and a half. This would really set this up of how you met Carlos. We'll talk a bit about that. But just the very, very first page and then over to the
I would love to, and
first
I love
two
your
pages.
Introduction to it. And maybe go into the little jumping in the sunflower so you see him.
Yeah, that'd be great.
His name was Carlos. Carlos Luis Salazar. And when his mother had troubles, I more or less stole him. Or that's what I always said. He was the son I wanted, and I did get him for a while. I didn't say goodbye to him, the boy I called Carlos. He'd made a long and dangerous trip to see me, and the next thing I heard, he was in a coma. I was the one who was asked, shall we turn off the machines? And I was the one who said yes. There wasn't a moment of hesitation about having Carlos suffer. I'll prepare him for you to come and see him, the nurse had told me. She took my arm to have your goodbye. She was gentle. Anyone could see how unprepared I was, trembling in the hallway. I didn't go with her and look at him dead. Too much life left in the memories, I murmured. Although she couldn't understand me, no one could. I wanted nothing to overlay those memories. I had no use for a word like closure. I was keeping as far from closing anything with Carlos as possible. And then was not the time, irregular as that is. It was the time to be overwhelmed and exhausted and, yes, frightened. I don't regret my decision. Whatever I did, it kept him as immediate as a piece of music played for all it's worth. Horowitz playing Scarlatti. I can hear it whenever I want to. Sometimes I get little snippets, a note or two. Sometimes it's an unexpected crescendo sweeping away whatever else makes up my days. I'm not surprised that what comes back is everything, but having it extend beyond the sum of the parts that carried us from there to here, does anyone count on such a thing? Maybe if I hadn't spoken at his funeral, I wouldn't have gotten started transcribing all his music. When I walked to the pulpit, I realized that words weren't necessary. We could all have come up and simply stood together before each other, witnesses. That is what we did afterwards. We stood together, Hispanics, whites, Indians, blacks, businessmen and women in suits, teachers, workmen in green pants and T-shirts, a few babies, quite a few hippies, fellow sojourners. An organ began to play Amazing Grace, and we started to sing. The spontaneity of it broke what was left of my composure. It was true of everyone. And we stood there singing and swiping at tears and remembering Carlos instead of having coffee and cookies. Charlie, the son Carlos had fathered unexpectedly, kept coming over to me, shuffling, his head down, reaching for my hand. He was the age Carlos had been when he left my house for the larger world. On Charlie's third pass by, he managed a few words. I didn't know these things about my father, he said. It could have been Carlos at 16. The same cap of dark hair, the beautiful features. You're Jerry Parker. You taught him. When he looked up, I saw something like amazement in his eyes. I kept track of what came back to me after that, for Charlie, as much as anyone. I didn't make any demands on myself, unities, continuity, any of that. Why should I? I just let Carlos take me, as he always had. And then this scene with the sunflowers. He dominated his street, what was left of it. To watch him there was to know that he was crazy about being Carlos Luis Salazar. It was 1964 when I first drove west to find him. I entered a part of Ogden I'd never been in, not 20 blocks from my own neighborhood. His little stucco house sat almost under the cement columns holding up the overpass that carved up Patterson Avenue. It was on the corner of the dead end it formed. If you stepped out of your car, you would hear traffic whirr by, sounding like so many wings beating the air. Life went on unimpeded in the stucco house. It was an indescribable color, not quite white, not sand, the color of wear. Before long, it would be turquoise, and that fit the activity on the street. There was laughter and commotion. Dark-skinned, dark-eyed children sat in the driveway in the sandy yard. They stood in groups of two or three along the picket fence, laughing and gesturing. They played jacks on the walkway below the kitchen window, its white curtains fluttering out over them. They looked like they'd been composed for a painting, the reds and greens and violets distributed among them. A street scene in rural Spain, poor and wonderful. Nothing to do with this northern town in Utah. And there was Carlos, doing his famous dives in the sunflowers, the scene that I was to see in my mind again and again. He was small, and it suited him. He made use of his size, flitting and frolicking. He taunted his relationship to gravity. He was Peter Pan on a string, whipped skyward. When he catapulted up, he went further than he should have. And when he made his arc and came down, he dropped like a stone. He was engaged in his endeavors. He could have been flying a jet for how absorbed he was. But there was abandon, too. He'd keep that for another 8 years. His head is going to strike that dirt like a watermelon, I was muttering, as he zoomed down through the extravagant leaves of the blazing yellow sunflowers. Then up he sailed again, and he did that perfect jackknife, even touching his toes before he dropped into the hard dirt. I winced. That was one of my first looks at this captivating young man.
I can just see him diving, diving the perfect jackknife there. And of course, your memories and your thoughts are going to not only be about this boy that you loved and who died early in his 20s, but also about language, because Carlos was deaf, was very imaginative. Let me see, you write later in the book, I wonder in what various and limiting ways those of us who have the luxury of early acquired language, easily acquired language, misspend it. And that's one of the points, isn't it? Carlos acquired language in a different way, and he was very imaginative with it.
He was a phrase maker even without having heard language, and he didn't get started with language training until he was six, which is just profoundly late. It's amazing he could acquire language. He was fully oral. He also could sign. But the subtleties of language, I was a person who taught French and English. I thought I had it pretty figured out, and along comes this little deaf boy and teaches me to hear. I became aware of the considerations that maybe don't come to mind. If language defines us, maybe adorns our personality, maybe at some point we'll come to think that it, in its way, is limiting, and there are things beyond that. When I was teaching French, I had a student who went on to be a doctor, Tom Rosenberg, here in Salt Lake City, later put me back together after some ski crashes. And just to show you how complicated it is for a hearing person, in French you say je and tu, I, you. And Tom would say je, although he wouldn't mind, I gave him a bad time about this. He'd say je, tu, je suis. And I'd say, Tom, you're saying je. He said, no, I said je. And everyone had laughed in the class, and we were close, and no one was feeling picked on. So finally I got out a recorder and said, Tom, I want you to say je. And he said, je. And I played the recording, and he said, yeah, I'm saying je. So we, as in writing and many things in life, we think we said what we set out to say. We may not have, even with the aid of hearing. For the deaf, it's just astonishingly complicated. Anyone that's begun to lose a little bit of hearing knows. I had a friend ask me if I wanted to go to the Greek festival the other day, and I said, do I need fruits and vegetables? it's very subtle in its sound, and it's all of the systems in place, grammatical and structural.
So you're saying we reveal what we really are saying when it's more difficult?
I think that's an interesting question, Tom. I think when the stakes are high, you do get the big revelations. And I really cared about getting it right in this book and wanted it to be love song to language as well as to this boy.
You waited, several years. Carlos must have died, in the 70s?
Yes, early 80s.
Early 80s, yeah. So you waited a while before you wrote this.
I did, but I have to say I'm a believer in aged wine, I guess I'd say. I took my time right from the first of knowing him. I wrote scenes and kept notes. I'm not a journal keeper, but I didn't want to lose the magic that this boy brought to his life. So I had stacks of notes, and he always wrote wonderful things and those amazing drawings that are in the book. So I had quite a record, but I would put the endeavor away for years and pick it up, and it was interesting to me to see what kinds of things you see later after you've let that rest and you've matured. For one thing, I was late in saying to myself, you know, this land that your people dominate belonged to his fathers. He should have had the gold in the arroyos. And I was glad that I came to see the historical significance and also the messages of what he represented. He was almost an index to the concerns of the decade that followed him. And I didn't immediately see that. There he was, the handicapped, the disadvantaged, the minority, the dropout, the drug enchanted for a very brief time. Very quickly he went to having "Don't Do Drugs" posted on his windows. The refugee from marriage, the welfare case, very short time for that. He was conscientious at the risk of his own health and having a job. The medical experiment. He seemed to be forgotten by his own decade, those concerns. And I wish I could say we'd made more progress in those social concerns.
Yeah, it does seem like he's, as you say, an index to that decade. We'll explore all of this further. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be back with Jerry Parker, who's author of a new memoir, 1,000 Voices. Which is it's a book about the love that she shared with this deaf boy and, of course, working through grief at his loss. He died in his 20s. Also, what's that?
He died in his 30s.
In his 30s, okay. And it's a meditation on language as well and memory. The book is 1,000 Voices. The author is Jerry Parker. Back after this break.
Who says staying fit can't be fun? Get on your way to a healthier, sweeter life on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. You'll get great tips for healthy living, like this recipe for
zesty turkey roll.
We always have a great time, so will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International.
Friday morning at 10 here on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the newest release from the Irish singer Mary Black and the traditional music release from Katie Hoffman. I'll also play songs from new albums by February Sky, The Green Children, and Kathy Fink and Marcy Marxer, among other talented artists. Tune in and listen this Saturday at 8 p.m. to Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're spending the hour with Jerry Parker, author of 1,000 Voices, her new memoir about Carlos Luis Salazar, who in 1964, when she was a high school teacher in Ogden, he was a student at the Utah School for the Deaf. They met, spent time together. This is a book about her love for this boy. Became a man, died in his 30s. Also about memories and language. In fact, Jerry Parker was instrumental in teaching him language. And he had its inimitable style. We'll talk a little bit about that as well, and his family. And as Jerry Parker has said, he's sort of an index to his decade, the 1970s mostly. And you're welcome to join this conversation if you would like at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, toll free, or an email to us at upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I wonder if you'd tell us story about the waste paper basket. This is a...
I should mention there's a promotion for the book right now. It's free on Kindle, on Amazon.
Okay.
And others, available sources, the King's English, Winter Beach Press, 801-484-7832. Well, here's a kid that nobody wanted as a teacher. He was just irrepressible, and he was a beautiful anarchist. It's one of the things I loved in him. Those were qualities I'd barely subdued in myself. And the best teacher in the school had him, and it's a good thing, as she was brilliant with him. But wondered, is he getting any of this first year? Other students would have been in early preschool programs, and he hadn't had that opportunity. So one day he was suddenly gone. That happened frequently, but it was always a concern. He was such a little elf. And suddenly all eyes moved around the room and centered on his wastebasket. You can see the big metal wastebaskets every classroom had. And he sprang up out of there and cried, "Throw me away!" His voice was bird-like, melodic, and he could do it with so much pizzazz that the sternest teacher would just crack up.
So out of the waste paper basket, throw me away, which is very appropriate.
And he always had that sense of play and irony with language, which is interesting. When I taught high school students before I went to the university, I quickly became aware that not everybody gets metaphor and analogy. I'd give students exercises to talk about what does it mean, strike while the iron is hot. And the students would say, "Well, if you plug the iron in and hit somebody, you really hurt them, and you burn them too."
you've imitated his voice, sort of a high voice.
Yes, and this would be before the cochlear implant, before you were able to augment sound enough to give that student a base to go by. It was typical to have, especially the young students, a voice be distorted and sometimes high. His was just captivating. It was hard to correct him. He was so imaginative. One day he said, "I will spring at the Saturday." How can you improve on "I will spring at the Saturday"? It was just one of those fabulous Saturdays.
But one of the idiomatic phrases that he modified that I liked is, "You drive me nervous."
Driving me nervous. I still say that. You're driving me nervous. And really, you'd say to yourself, I should be correcting this, but some of it is so poetic. Mm-hmm. Kirkus Review wrote a marvelous review, but one of the things the fellow said was, Jerry Parker seems to find poetry in ungrammatical sentences. I smiled at that. I thought, "Oh, you're still young, honey." But all of the deaf students that were ungrammatical, that were trying to put language together, weren't poetic. It weren't charming. It doesn't always work to get it wrong. If you had some kind of poetic quality in him that let him combine things in ways that were just wonderful. He proposed to me. By the time he was 16, he proposed to me. This was his proposal. "I will wife you."
I will wife you.
I will wife you.
Yeah.
Hard to beat.
Yeah. In fact, each chapter, each section of the book begins with a phrase of Carlos's.
Yes.
That was important. You say you wanted to capture his voice, right? And there are a lot of different meanings to voice. I want to talk about the title, A Thousand Voices. What did you mean there?
You've got the charm of the actual voice, and you've got the echo of the meaning behind the voice, and you've got the historical sense of what does this voice mean. And I think one of the things I felt strongly about was, here's the voice of an unsung hero. Here's the voice of someone you might not have encountered. And he'll show you things. Maybe in some ways it's more accessible to tell the story of the unknown person You don't come with it with expectations. You pick up Cleopatra, and you have a whole sense of what she is and what she should be, and you're going to measure and judge by that. But with Carlos Luis Salazar, you're wide open.
I wonder if I'd have you read another passage from the book. This is page 127. And kind of gets into, it's sort of a mysterious thing, why two people connect. What is it? It happens to us. It's hard to explain. This whole book is about that the love you and Carlos shared. And, of course, language and memory and many other themes. But I wonder if just have you, in fact, read the entire section. It's only about a page. This is a section called Nothing Want.
Yes, and this is after he's gathered his things. He'd lived at my house for a time and returned to Patterson Avenue. He was perfect in his sense of what the next step in his life should be, in most of the steps. And there was a time when that was a right decision, but it was painful. But that was after the I will wife you section. So many years passed before it seemed quite natural to me that Carlos and I should have been a little in love with each other for a time. But eventually I came to see that, like so many before us, we were destined to lose our hearts to our Pygmalions. If he was in some ways my creation, certainly he bore my imprint where language was concerned. I was as much marked by his shaping. And no shaping is so deep, I had found, as that tied to how we are able to express ourselves and how we are able to be understood. But such philosophical considerations were not comforting at the moment. And for fact, they were not even possible. In time, they were. I admired the efficiency that had let Carlos gather himself together and go home. Wasn't this separation a gift of strength rather than a weak retreat? Would I have had him cling to me into manhood rather than stride from that possibility any way he could? And I came to understand why he'd said when I'd asked him if he wanted to bring his belongings with him, "Nothing want." As I packed away his blue blazer and ice skates, along with shirts and vests and pants and caps and suits and Boy Scout knives and binoculars and TAWS, I remembered again the brown paper bag he'd brought from his home when he'd come to live with me. In it had been a pair of socks and two pairs of shorts. He had his shirt on, he explained. I realized with dismay that I'd heightened the contrast between his two worlds with my indulgences. Of course he didn't want to trundle gold Neruda jackets to the neighborhood where, at the moment, the style was closer to stowaway than cutting edge. If I thought about it, it was a style I preferred myself. Trying to learn from him, I looked to my own life. I like your selecting that passage, Tom. That one thing I didn't want to do was write a quick sniffle memoir, a soft thing. I wanted it to be real and tough and full of the complexities as well as the joys and delights.
And Carlos, you say he was beautiful, physically beautiful. He had this just very striking personality. I wonder how you felt when later on he sort of tore at that beauty. He disdained it. In fact, became, you describe him as slovenly.
When he was in the full heat of adolescence, he got belligerent, showy, a little rough in his manner, let his hair grow wild as could be, and he did kind of throw that down as disdain. I think it was part of what you see a lot of adolescents go through, that enormously sassy stage. He later was on heavy doses of prednisone and lost those beautiful looks, and he wasn't unaware that he was good looking. he said to me once, "My body's almost a monster. My body's almost a monster," and walked me through the cuts and scars and invasions, the fistulas, the swelling from prednisone. Mm. And he acquired a different beauty, a better beauty, really.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Jerry Parker, spending the hour with her, and her new memoir, A Thousand Voices, talks about a little 10-year-old deaf boy she met and was very important to him, he to her. It's about that relationship, about language and memory and many other themes. Carlos Luis Salazar's who we're talking about, and that's who the memoir is about. And you're welcome to join the conversation at 1-800-826-1495 or go to upraxcess@gmail.com. And Jerry Parker, your book available on Kindle and at Amazon, King's English, various other places, you were telling me. I wonder if you could talk a little more in depth about language acquisition. We should preface this by saying that, and you write in your book, that this was back in the day when the goals of deaf education were different. This would probably be frowned upon the deaf community today, you know, teaching language. They've settled on, zeroed in on signing. There's a whole deaf culture. But at that point, I think the goal was to, if they could, have them acquire language.
I like the direction you take this, Tom. There were some more complexities in that community. The sense among deaf parents that they wanted their children to do what they did. Deaf parents from an earlier time than oral instruction and wanted them to be signing, and interestingly wanted them only to be signing. And then there was the world of people that felt like that's important and you should have that, but you could have both. His brother was also deaf, born congenitally deaf. There's a redundancy, but just a beautiful redundancy. And I took them both to buy a pair of shoes, and Carlos could say, "That's too tight." And it was just difficult to not deal with his brother, who had no language at all. It was just a slower process and a limited process. You had to know signing or you weren't in the loop at all. Along came the cochlear implant, and you saw some furor over that. But in this era, we were taught as deaf teachers how to help someone learn to pick meaning from a mouth motion. And since only 40% of language is visible on the lips, it took enormous concentration and skill. If you were to say ba, pa, or ma, you could, if you're listening, say those to yourself. And if you say them in front of a mirror, you see that there is no difference at all in the mouth motion. So if you don't hear the nasal sound, the mmm sound, or hear the plosive sound, you can mix them up. It was stunning to me how much language could be acquired, how amazing the brain is to accommodate to a loss and fill in. Carlos was a crack lip reader. He could say to his doctors, "I have not had 2,500 cc's of coke." But lip read, they're saying that's enough fluid.
And there was a connection as well, wasn't there, in terms of sort of this vividness that both of you at least wanted. You wanted, and maybe he had in a little more abundance. One of the quotes from the book, you both wanted the astonishing blues and yellows of life.
We had a tremendous amount of fun together. I guess that was the first tie. He was a great mime, a great player, tease. Had just a tremendous zest for life. We went fishing. I took him skiing, camping, and went up to my cabin in Idaho and had this relish, this fun. You know, when you learn a foreign language and suddenly language becomes new for you, or you have a friend that speaks another language and you're teaching them about your world, a foreign exchange student, say, it's all new and all fresh. And that was the feeling I had with Carlos, just discovering the world through his very rich connections.
I wonder if you talk about his family, his mother, Lily, I guess Carlos came to be with you because of some troubles they were having in the family. First of all, tell us about Lily. You were fascinated by her language.
I was just thinking about Lily. She was one of my favorite people in the world. And I'd say in the 20-some years that we really shared this boy, there never was a moment of competition or domination. I think her motivation in letting him come to me was fully what's best for him. She'd seen what happened with drugs and knives. I think in many ways he was her favorite child. She looked a great deal like him. She had this way of talking. I couldn't like to imitate her. When I first met him, I came to the house. She said, does he know you? She spoke just very, very quickly. And I said, well, just barely, as I was going to take him on an outing. And I said, I met him at the school benefit. And she said, benefit? I never forgot how fast she said that word. When you say that word as fast as you can, it's as funny as can be. Uh-huh. I always thought of silver scissors cutting up a strand of taffy, the bits dropping mysteriously into words. So I was very sensitive to how different cultures handle language, do things with language. It interested me all my life. I'd say if there's one thing I'd want this book to speak for, it's that the information is in the differences, not the similarities. Step outside the world that's familiar to you, and there's a lot of insight and knowledge and fascination there.
Are you talking about differences in language, differences in personality, just general differences?
All of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think I would have said at some early point, I might have felt, why would Lily let this boy go? I came to think that it was a much tighter family than my own, and I didn't know the signs of that, and I came to see that I'd been taken into that family, and it was a great compliment. Lily, one of the things I could see is you can be on the sidelines of another economic strata or another ethnic strata, and it'll take you quite a while to understand it. She was poor, she was proud, she was capable, she held that family together the way she could. There were some genetic flukes. The brother died of renal failure 2 months after Carlos died. It's a most unusual, very rare syndrome called Alport syndrome. One of the things I want to mention is that I was so intent on putting this book in the hands of his son, who'd said to me at his funeral, I read that, I didn't know these things about my father. He would have heard other things. So I went looking for that son and found his sister. It happens that she lives in the very house he was born in on Patterson Avenue, and it was full joy to find her. She's abundant and talented. She's painted that little house and planted flowers. She has a great job, a beautiful family. She's thrived. But there are only two left out of the eight children, and they all died very, very close together. I said to her, you lost six family members, including your mother, so close together, within 4 or 5 years. Well, she was swiping at tears. So was I. But not with any self-indulgence at all, just with the survivors, you know. I made it, and I loved them.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Jerry Parker, author of a new memoir, 1,000 Voices. And we're going to continue this conversation after a brief break.
Support for this program on UPR is made possible in part by our listeners and the Utah Division of Security.
This is folk singer Michael Jonathan inviting you to tune in to the next broadcast of Wood Songs. We have two great artists, the Honeycutters and Granville Automatic.
Now I'm 21 and all I've got's my honor.
Both artists, music, and conversation on the next broadcast of the Wood Songs, Old Time Radio.
Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Coming up on the next Bluegrass Breakdown, there are mood boosters, immune system strengtheners, appearance enhancers, and stress relievers. They're wildly contagious, confusing to approaching frowns, and are curves that set everything straight. I'm Dave Higgs, and with the help of the Grass Cats, Rhonda Vincent, and Bill Clifton, we'll be looking at high and lonesome smiles on the next Bluegrass Breakdown.
Saturday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest this hour is Jerry Parker, author of a new memoir, A Thousand Voices. It's a memoir of her time with, when she first met him, a beautiful, wild 10-year-old deaf boy, Carlos Luis Salazar, and through to the end of his life in his 30s. The early, I believe, 1980s. The story begins in the 1960s. And Jerry Parker, I wonder if I could have you read one more passage.
I'd love to.
This is page 206. This is very near the end of the book. Powerful, very beautifully written. Maybe starting just one paragraph into page 206 and then down to over the page, I knew it wasn't his life, ending there. This is, should say, Carlos is dying, and you were tasked, I guess, with making some very important end-of-life decisions.
I was. I had met Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen. I was head of women's programs at Westminster College and put together conferences, and she was a guest speaker at one of them. Some of you will know her wonderful book, My Grandfather's Blessings, and run get it if you don't have it. She had said to me, call when you don't know what to do. And many years went by, and one night I called her in the middle of the night, and she posed these questions, and those are a little earlier than the section you want me to read, I think. One of them was, why was he born? What is his purpose? What are the qualities unique to him? Was it about there?
Yes. I guess maybe just starting with why was he born and then continuing to I knew it wasn't his life.
Okay, great. He's dying now, and I know that, and I'm trying to handle it and trying to think how to help him. Why was he born, she asked softly. Oh, there was reason, so terribly much reason. Everywhere I looked, whatever segment of his life I took up, from his leaps in the sunflowers to his running frantic and lost in the foothills, and coming back, always coming back, there were reasons time without end for Carlos. What is his purpose? She asked again. And again I was still watching in my mind the ancient human struggle of a boy coming to understand himself and to move beyond his limitations. It was all against the odds for Carlos, yet triumph is the word that most comes to mind in thinking about his life. Without having had language, he was a phrase maker. Without having had an advanced education, he became sophisticated in the most wonderful sense of the word. Without having had health, he lived fully and deeply. Without having had a merciful life, he was compassionate. Without having had money, he brought riches. With so much to endure, he did endure. Again, a question. What are the qualities unique to him? He danced before my eyes, rare and brilliant as a field of wildflowers. Wherever he was and in whatever condition, he provided a gathering place for laughter and camaraderie. Once he had surprised me with the gift of a miniature cast iron stove like the one my grandmother had had in the cabin at the sawmill. "Why are you giving me a present?" I asked. "For love," was his answer. Again, Rachel asked a question and waited. Has he finished? For the first time in looking at his altered life, I could acknowledge the possibility that he might have, but that I didn't know, I wouldn't know. She asked a last question. What is the worst thing he can lose now? I knew it wasn't his life. Rachel said it better than I could have. Your work, Jerry, is to take care of his spirit, to keep him close to his identity. That's your part. Keep seeing his strength, his spirit, and reflect these back to him. You must say to yourself, I am a friend of this young man's soul. How am I going to let that help him keep what he is? Use your knowledge of this man. You have the peace that no one else has.
You know, very, very powerful. And those are very wise questions your friend asked of you there.
They've been guides. Yeah. And people, readers, have responded to those in readings. And that, yeah.
You said elsewhere in the book that you wanted to preserve memories, and I think for that reason you didn't go in and see him after he died.
I'm interested now in that decision. I had been in the hospital 40 days, and I'd been there every day. I was exhausted beyond anything. His mother was with me. She's the one who'd said, "Can you make this decision? Because I can't." She was Catholic. She would not have been comfortable to turn off those machines. And I just wanted to see him leaping in the sunflowers. Yeah.
And you think that did help you preserve those memories?
I think it's all I could do at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't think anything could have dimmed them, really. In a way, I'm glad I don't have a memory of him stilled.
I wonder about the nature of memories. And you know, you've thought about this and worked through this a bit in this memoir. Did you keep journals, or was this kept in your heart?
Both. I never was disciplined enough to write down something every day or every night, but I kept records. I wrote down phrases and scenes, and I had boxes of things. We'd both written each other a lot of letters, so I had his writing and my writing to him about the events we'd shared. Memory is fascinating. It's, of course, I sometimes call it a lewd vagrant. You know, it's pretty tricky. It could shift around and you'll see it remember something a way someone else would say, no, that's not how it had at all was at all. But in a way, it's our ascribing meaning to our experiences, going back and finding what the larger messages of that experience were. And I think it's wonderful that we fashion them to aid us and comfort us and amuse us. I never felt the slightest obligation to have it be as factual as a film of this life would have been. I don't mean by that I purposely altered things, but of course you select what you present. He was damn good material. It was hard to miss.
But I guess memories change over time, and we have an active role in that. I guess you're saying we fashion and shape how those memories are shaped.
I think we should. I think we should let them mature in us. And I think that's exactly what the impulse to write is, to go back and mine experience for all it's worth. I was asked to write a piece for writers, especially writers over 40, by someone, and I'd say to those of you who are examining your life and looking at it, wondering if it's too late to begin, it's never too late, not until you don't recognize the words on the page. Mm. take the wild horse and go for the long ride through the meadows and timber and the underbrush and come out with a story only you can tell. And whether we put it in words or just store it inside us and tell our grandchildren, it's a distinctly human thing, isn't it? I haven't seen my chickens do that. I expect that they would crow here in a minute. We have a little local color.
It is. I was just thinking. It is so important, such an impulse to remember your experiences, remember, in this case, Carlos's, and to tell.
Yes. I can't walk past this book and see this cover with the drawing. I did the drawing of it of him on the cover, and without thinking, oh, he's gathered together all right there in this one place, and I love to see it. I had, speaking of the right people, just a fabulous editor in New York, a beautiful intermediary between the world you're in and the world your story comes from. She had that great sense of its deepest currents. And her husband worked for Martha Stewart Living, was a designer. And so what a package. He designed the cover. And just a lot of people stepped up and said, let me do this piece.
Well, we have reached the end of our hour together. The memoir is 1,000 Voices. The author is Jerry Parker, a book available at King's English and online, Kindle, Amazon, and various other places. By the way, if you just Google Jerry Parker, in fact, it's jerryparker.com is the website. Jerry Parker, a pleasure. Thanks for spending the hour with us.
The pleasure was mine, Tom. Thank you.
And join us tomorrow. Sherry Quinn will be having some reports from the Small Satellite Conference ongoing at Utah State University. We'll, of course, cover science with Sherry Quinn tomorrow on Access Utah. Thanks for listening today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.